Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for clicking on the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, we get a different perspective on the Democratic loss in the race for president in 2016. The new book is called How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. As you'll discover, Hillary Clinton didn't actually write this book, but her words are most prominently featured in it, along with commentary by veteran journalist Joe Lauria, who's been a frequent contributor to this podcast. It's got a foreword by Julian Assange, and Joe Lauria gives you samples, excerpts from the various emails of Hillary Clinton and her campaign that surfaced during the 2016 election cycle. And using her own words, he demonstrates why he believes Hillary Clinton lost. It's not cheesy or tawdry. It is focused on the powerful issues that should have been central to the campaign last year. I invite you to listen and send me your comments. This podcast is made possible by subscriptions from people like you and Virginia Suitors Mason, who I believe is cruising off the coast of British Columbia right now. Also, I want to thank Patrick Garay, Benny Alto, and Steve Wozenski. They're all regular subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. You can join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber. Then you're on the sign-up page, and you can figure it out from there. Journalist Joe Lauria returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today. He has contributed the introduction and annotation to a new book called How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Based on her own words, in speeches and emails, a devastating indictment of a disastrous election defeat. Take it away, Tim Buck III.
Presidential elections. Our planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes. Like a game of chess when the house is a mess, or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble, or a football game when there's rioting in the streets.
That's a tune from the 80s called Just Another Movie by Tim Buck III. And absolutely, the 2016 campaign was wild and a series of planned distractions. And the biggest, of course, surprise was to the diehard Hillary Clinton supporters who really believed that she could not lose and that Trump could not win. Joe Lauria has just published a powerful new book. It's based on the emails that were released via the State Department Trove and some of those that were released via WikiLeaks last year. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Peter, for having me back on your show.
Well, I'm really glad. You made me aware that you were working on this project a few months ago. And what you have done is, I think, a significant contribution to the forensic look at the 2016 election, because we've seen so many diversions offered. It was the Russians. It was James Comey. It was this, that. It was because she was a woman. And what we realize is when you get objective about it and boil it down, she was a lousy candidate who ran a terrible campaign with severe self-inflicted wounds. And your book, with your smart commentary, I think gives people an insight into that.
Absolutely. As you know, and your listeners know, there's another book out about the her campaign that's, I think, made the New York Times bestseller list. And that is inside the bubble of the campaign itself and deals with the tactics, technical mistakes that were made. And it's quite written by reporters who were inside that campaign bubble, writing about other people on the campaign team, the deputy of John Kerry in the 2004 election. I mean, really inside baseball stuff. And while it says that Hillary Clinton is just wants to talk about policy, I haven't finished reading the book, but what I've read so far of that book, there's nothing about policy. It's a campaign book, and there have been so many campaign books like that, and every campaign that's existed has had this kind of infighting and jealousy and screaming candidates and that kind of stuff. But what I think is missing from the discussion right now is a look at the policies that she had. I firmly believe that her wrong policies, particularly for this time right now, in 2016, with this anti-establishment fervor on the left, on the Democratic and Republican side, that her policies were completely mistaken. Now, it's clear she didn't talk much about policy during the campaign itself. There was this study, interesting study that came out afterward, that showed that something like 20 or 25% of her ads, TV ads, were about policy, and the others were about Donald Trump and how she was different. So their strategy was to attack Trump, not talk about policy.
Well, and also there were talking points that she used, but many of them were remarkably bland, and I'm sure that they were crafted with focus group approval. But one that stands out that shows up repeatedly in the segments of email that you chose to publish and comment on, and that is when she talks about our Fourth Amendment rights and the undermining since 9/11. She has this carefully crafted line about how we got to strike a balance of civil liberties, privacy, and security. And it's something that Obama has used repeatedly. And it appears to play pretty well, where people think, oh, she cares about my privacy and about my civil liberties. But she never goes into any detail. And when you look at how she demonized Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning, she's not too interested in transparency and disclosure. She cares mostly about the security leg of that three-legged stool. And she loves to use a three-legged stool as her talking point.
Yeah, not at all. She cares about as the title of that section is. She takes the side of the state versus the people. But as I was saying, she didn't talk so much about policy. But these emails are so valuable that WikiLeaks provided for us, because we got an insight into what her policy is, what she really thinks, not what she tried to say in debates where she had to make some policy pronouncements, and what her ideas are were totally unwelcomed amongst the electorate. This year, she is essentially shows herself as an elitist, an economic elitist, and a hawk. She's unquestionably a hawk, and I don't think that the mood of the population at this time, and particularly amongst the Rust Belt workers, where she lost this election in the Electoral College, was receptive anymore to more wars and to more jobs being shipped overseas, and the deindustrialization of the country continuing, and someone so close to Wall Street. And this is who she was. So ultimately, the working class people of the country spoke. Now, unfortunately, Donald Trump was clever. I don't know who put this idea in his head, whether it was Steve Bannon or whether he thought of this himself, because the guy's sometimes an idiot savant. He does come up every once in a while. It'd be like every 120th statement he makes actually makes sense. See, he understood the message to that section of the population that he was going to bring the jobs back, he was going to end regime change, he was going to improve relations with Russia to lessen tensions, and this won him the election, in my view. And he's throwing everything now to reverse a lot of that, obviously. This health insurance bill would take away, as we know, so many people's health insurance, the people who voted for him. So he lied about it, it looks like now. I never necessarily bought it, but you know, we had no record of who Donald Trump was. We had a long record of Hillary Clinton.
Well, let me seize that point, because you know, I look at the political science fundamentals before we even get into the personalities and her weakness as a candidate. And that is, for the Democrats to hold the White House after 8 years of Obama is a difficult hurdle to clear. It's not impossible, but historically we've seen that the American electorate tends to want to push out the party that's been in power and try the other one. Secondly, yeah. Hillary, for better or worse, and fairly or unfairly, is saddled with over 25 years of Clinton negatives, some of which are well-deserved and many of which were projections that came out of the Arkansas Project. And David Brock was the master of the takedown efforts of Bill Clinton and then, you know, flipped to the other side and became the diabolical communications boss of the Clinton campaign in 2016. And in between there, many people hardened their perceptions of Hillary Clinton. And so by the time we got to the end of the primaries last year, and many progressives were bitter about the way the DNC tilted in favor of Clinton and hammered Sanders wherever they could, we had a group of disaffected Democrats. And then there were many people, including the women who voted for Trump, who did so largely because they were taking a chance on Trump. They felt that they could not take that risk with Clinton because they knew too much about her. And so even before we get to the issues of the campaign, she had such huge deficits that, again, the risk-taking establishment of the Democratic Party, which was unwilling to give Bernie Sanders a shot, was willing to bet everything on damaged goods.
Yes, she was well-known, and that did not serve her very well. That's absolutely correct. And she walked into an anti-establishment year, and she's the quintessential establishment candidate. She is status quo, and people took a chance on Trump, as you said. Not that they were giving very good choices, because they were fed up with the status quo. Enough voters, anyway, was fed up with them to elect him. It was a gamble, I think. Because they knew too well what Hillary Clinton was and what she would be, no matter what she was saying. She's famous for shifting her positions according to what the expediency is at the moment. You know, when Bernie Sanders came out of nowhere to challenge her, she started tacking to the left. I make the point in the book that the political press corps, you know, takes that as normal. Okay, now she's going left. I mean, wait a minute. What did she say 2 months ago? So it's clear when it's not just Hillary Clinton. All politicians seem to be able to easily change core positions. They have no conviction, and they proved that. And this time, that you know, she didn't get away with that, and a lot of stuff that establishment politicians like her have gotten away with for decades.
Yeah,
didn't work
for
her this time.
As an example, when she flipped on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, after praising it as it was secretly negotiated, starting while she was Secretary of State, it was obvious to any of us who'd been opposed to the process and to the package along the way that this was opportunism on her part. Likewise, when she said Me Too about college tuition but wouldn't really take as firm a stand as Sanders, she said Me Too on raising the minimum wage, but she thought $12 was as far as you could get. And so she tacked left, she often undermined her own credibility, which drove up the polling numbers about people perceiving her negatively on honesty and trustworthiness.
Yeah, you know, she shifted on TPP the day after the Podesta emails were released, in which all the Wall Street speeches that she had guarded from publication, that she refused to release, even the New York Times, which was pretty much in her corner, wrote a very scathing editorial about her decision not to make public these speeches. So they are released, and the next day she goes on the NewsHour and says that she's all of a sudden against TPP. She lost enormous credibility, whatever she had going into this year. But you're right, a lot of things conspired against her, that she was damaged goods, as you say, I think is a good way to put it. But again, she was expected to win right up until Election Day.
Right. Well, Joe, I don't think I've told you this, but listeners may have heard me talk about this. Last summer in July, I went to Detroit and to Cincinnati. That's where my families are from. And I was astounded that people who had voted Democratic all their lives were talking up Trump. And that was the guys. Their wives were anguished because they, you know, had their fill of the Clintons, didn't particularly care for Hillary, but they cringed at Trump's sexism and his obvious deficits. And so really it was at that point that I realized that Trump could win. And in fact, in early August, after both conventions were concluded, in an interview with Thomas Frank, I made him a $5 bet, reluctantly, that Trump was going to win. And I don't say this to, you know, try to burnish any reputation as a prognosticator. I was just it was just clear to me that she had no room to grow, to attract new voters, to convert young people who'd been drawn to Bernie Sanders. And so, you know, I had to give the advantage to Trump because he was willing to lower every bar in order to attack her. And there were limits to how far she would or could go to join him in the gutter.
Did he pay up the $5?
He's threatening to, but I haven't collected yet.
Well, you know, I thought that she was going to win, like just about everyone else. However, I did write an article 3 days before the election on the Huffington Post, which anybody can go and see, in which I said if she were to lose, she's going to blame this on Russia. And they're going to try to get the electors in Electoral College to change their votes. If that doesn't work, they're going to try to get Congress not to certify Trump. That didn't work. Now they're trying to use this Russia thing to get him impeached. So, and apparently in that other book I mentioned before about the campaign, it's revealed that the next day, yes, you can mention, it's mentioned the day after they lost, they talked about talking up Russia.
Yeah.
So I predicted that. I predicted how they'd react to the loss. I did not predict that she would lose, though, as you did. So,
well, I don't take any real pleasure in it. I was not comfortable supporting Hillary myself, but in the, you know, lesser of two evils, I certainly didn't want to see us go on this experimental Trump route, and it is devastating already in so many respects. But I want to turn to the focus of your book, because people may think that you went through all of the State Department emails and then the DNC emails and then John Podesta's looking for dirt and embarrassment. And Joe, to your credit, you really focused on what should have been the central issues of the campaign if the media hadn't permitted itself to chase the latest tweet from Trump. And let's talk in particular about one of the key reasons I couldn't support Clinton last year, and that was her strong advocacy for military intervention in Syria as early as 2011 or 2012. And you cite the Defense Intelligence Agency document from August of 2012, which really did predict the rise of an actual quote-unquote Islamic State out of the ashes of the Sunni military and some people we locked up during the occupation of Iraq. And there are other factors that contributed to it. But it appears that she completely ignored that intelligence. And they made this devil's bargain that we'll let the Islamic State operate as long as they're a potent threat to Bashar al-Assad, because that regime change is our ultimate goal there. And they viewed, you know, I remember Obama referred to ISIS or the Islamic State as the junior varsity, the JV. Well, they were content to allow them to function and grow because they saw them as a useful tool, a proxy tool against Assad. And then it kind of spun out of control. That's my take on it.
Well, there's two things that I have here in the book. One is that Defense Intelligence Agency document, which says that Turkey and the Gulf Arab states, the U.S. and a couple of European powers were supporting the establishment of a Salafist principality in eastern Syria that could join up with the extremists in Iraq, the ones you just mentioned, that came directly from the invasion of Iraq by Bush, because many Ba'ath Party leaders joined ISIS and become commanders there after the army was disbanded by the Bush administration, and that they could join together and create an Islamic State. They actually used that phrase. This is August 2012. It, was declared on August 2014. Al-Baghdadi declared the establishment of the Islamic State. So that document completely predicted it. Not only did Hillary Clinton ignore it, and it came out in the summer when she was bugging Obama to support and arm rebels in Syria.
The moderates.
And he, to his, yeah, the moderates that they never could actually find, and they actually admitted that eventually. So that document shows that they allowed the establishment of it. Now, it became a Frankenstein, but how did they react to that? Go to another piece of evidence that I draw attention to, which is this audio recording, and there's a link in the book to where you can go online and hear it. John Kerry, last September, September 2016, on the borders of the UN General Assembly, he met with some Syrian exiles in the United States, some opposition exile people, and he says, and you could hear him, that we saw Daesh growing, we saw ISIS growing, and we saw it moving towards Damascus, and we thought this could put pressure on Assad to step down, but then he got Putin to come in and help. He got Russia to come in and help him, and he says clearly in this tape, Kerry, that the reason Russia intervened is because they were afraid that ISIS would take over in Damascus. So there's two really important things Kerry says in this tape. Number one, he's confirming what we learned from the DIA document from 4 years earlier, which is that they wanted this group to be established and supported to put pressure on Assad. And that's exactly what Kerry says he still wanted them to do, even when they were marching towards Damascus. So they were risking, the Obama administration was risking losing Damascus to these guys who would be far more dangerous than Assad has ever been. Assad has not even threatened Israel, despite his rhetoric, let alone Western Europe. And we've just seen another horrific attack claimed by them in Manchester, and the attacks in the U.S. and in Russia, the Russian plane coming out of Egypt, and of course Paris and Brussels. This is the group that the United States was playing with to possibly take over in Damascus, who is an absolute threat. Putin said they had to be stopped, and he offered in September 2015 at the General Assembly, a year before the Kerry comments, to the Obama administration to join together in an anti-ISIS alliance, just like the Soviet Union and the U.S. got together, even though they didn't love each other, to fight Hitler. And the Americans immediately rejected it. Now, over the next year, Kerry and Obama started to work with Lavrov and Putin to actually create this thing. And if you know, they were on the verge of starting this alliance when the Pentagon made a mistake and killed 65 Syrian soldiers and killed it. It looked like Ash Carter, who publicly came out against this agreement, may have engineered a way to destroy it by killing Syrian soldiers, even though they said this was a mistake. And there's a lot of evidence to show that they had to have known who they were killing. So John Kerry's tape and that DIA document shows that the fire they were playing with the Islamic State, and that they really knew the reason why Russia came into this war, not to extend their imperial glory in the Middle East, which is what we hear Hillary Clinton and all the others have said, and the corporate media just lapping it all up, of course, which gives credibility. If it was direct government statements, if it was a government media, no one would believe them. But when we have a corporate media that is so sycophantic towards our rulers, then it looks like it's been vetted. And we know that the corporate press has lost that ability, as I point out, that they would have had during the 70s when the Church Committee and the intelligence investigations of the Congress came out and revealed all the dirty things and abuses that the U.S. intelligence agencies had committed from the end of the Second World War until the mid-70s when they were spying. There were no warrants. There was none of that. That all came later because of these investigations. We saw that this is the kind of dirty stuff that the U.S. was doing then. And Hillary Clinton, I'm losing my train of thought. Hillary Clinton is a supporter of this intervention, and she knew that also, like John Kerry did, that Russia was coming in to stop this ISIS from taking over in Damascus.
And Joe, that's
an important point.
We get a narrative that is woefully incomplete and is often, you know, focused on a Russia-U.S. axis. And we know that our good friends, the Saudis, who just celebrated a visit from Trump, have been funding some of the so-called rebel fighting groups in Syria. We know that the Emirates have been providing funding for separate rebel groups. And we never criticize that. We don't call it out. And the American people have a very muddled picture of a complex conflict in Syria. And it is not helped by our political figures who always try to reduce it to a cartoon level and don't acknowledge the mistakes in American policy. And this was one of the biggest reasons, you know, based on her own service as Secretary of State, that I couldn't support Hillary Clinton for president.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. She's, what can we say? You know.
Well, and after, you know, when you put that together with her strong advocacy for the intervention in Libya that led to the takedown of Gaddafi and her snarky comments about that, it was just, once again, exposure to somebody who is certainly very knowledgeable and appears to be competent, but she is captive to the wrong groupthink. And in my view, that's really what disqualified her as president. Remember, there was that exchange where at one point Bernie Sanders said that she was unqualified and got pounced on by all kinds of women's groups. I felt that the right term was disqualified. I think on paper and, you know, just based on other people who've run for president, she was clearly qualified. But I felt she disqualified herself by her record in too many respects.
Well, that depends on how you define qualified. I mean, in terms of a resume, yeah. But in terms of her actions and her policy positions, I don't think she was very qualified. Libya being a premier example. As much as foreign policy figured into this election, she was the mastermind of that, and the emails show that. And that's the point I wanted to make when you talked about Saudi Arabia and Qatar having supported ISIS and Al-Qaeda. How do we know this? From one of her own emails, she wrote this. Mm-hmm. She didn't write that the princes, you know, or some private charities were doing this, and they may have well as she said the governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia are supporting ISIS. And we also know Joe Biden, in a speech in Harvard, said so. He had to apologize to tell him the truth later on. And here's Donald Trump going to Saudi Arabia and lavishing them with this incredible amounts of new weaponry, as they lavished him with the pomp and circumstance that they knew that he relished. Mm-hmm. They knew they can get him. They can get him with that kind of, you know, they have similar tastes. If you look at the the interior of that apartment of Trump's in the Trump Tower, it's the same gaudy, gold, disgusting, over-the-top taste that the Saudi royals and Donald Trump have, believe it or not. And I think he had to have loved the horses and the flags.
Well, and we know we know that the word gauche is not in the Donald's vocabulary.
No, he has no idea what that means. They got him.
Yeah. I want to make this parallel because there has been some critical commentary, that Trump took the kids along. Jared Kushner is credited with engineering the $110 billion arms deal. And his wife, Ivanka, went on the trip, and there's this photo of her between King Salman and some other prince. And she was able to get them to kick back $100 million to an entrepreneurs fund for women that Ivanka is credited for starting at the World Bank. Now, I find this tawdry and transactional and offensive, but we need to acknowledge, and this came out in Hillary's emails as well, that she approved an arms deal to Saudi Arabia, I believe it was in 2010, and shortly thereafter, millions of dollars arrived from Saudi sources at the Clinton Foundation. Now, it appears that Ivanka actually squeezed more out of them than Hillary and Bill were able to. But to me, this tawdry connection between the Secretary of State and her staff and the Clinton Foundation and its staff is seriously problematic. And I think if there ever were to be an investigation into the foundation and the emails, we would see even more than we know already. But let's tick it off that Huma Abedin was on the payroll of the State Department, the Clinton Foundation, and Teneo, Doug Band's lobby shop, all at the same time while she was fielding requests from Doug Band to give special treatment to the Crown Prince of Bahrain, who needed an appointment with Hillary. And after that meeting, it appears that Clinton did adjust our policy toward Bahrain and backed away from including it in the Arab Spring, support for aspiring democracy. And so, you know, I believe that there are serious issues that have been partly exposed that deserve a deeper and objective investigation.
Well, I would say it looked very bad, and the Hume Aberdeen having one foot in the foundation and one in the State Department, and another one in Teneo, as you say, absolutely looks bad. But I take a slightly more nuanced and softer approach to her and the foundation. We could use an investigation, and things might be found. But right now, it's more of a scandal of perception, and that perception is somebody like Huma Abedin making appointments while someone who gave a donation. But when you talk about a Saudi arms deal or Qatar, these countries, U.S. has been selling arms to them for decades. So I think whether or not money was given by Qatar and Saudi Arabia to – Qatar gave $100 million, I think, to the foundation as a birthday gift for Bill Clinton. They would be selling them arms anyway. So you'd have to really dig into that to see if there's any quid pro quo there. I think that you can't say that they sold the arms to Saudi Arabia because of this gift. They would probably have sold that money anyway. So I think that we have to be careful about the foundation. I know the FBI supposedly is looking into it. That's dropped. The foundation has lost a lot of its donors. Now, there's no question that those guys who've given money, wealthy individuals, governments, people like that, knew that just she could become president. They also believed she was going to win on November 8th. So sure, they were trying to get on the right side of her by helping her foundation. I don't think there's any question about that. That was some kind of influence there. Well, whether any crimes were committed, we don't know if any crimes were committed.
Yeah. Joe, let me pull one other thread. And to your credit, you include quite a bit of Sid Blumenthal's emails to Secretary of Clinton. And Sid Blumenthal, for people who don't recall, is a longtime Clinton retainer, was a White House staffer in the 90s. And at the time he was sending almost daily emails to the Secretary of State, he was pulling down $10,000 a month from the Clinton Foundation. But that was not enough. He was also pursuing deals. And one of the things he did was broker a deal between Joe Wilson, whose wife Valerie Plame was, notorious back in the Bush administration. And Joe Wilson and Valerie did a TV commercial endorsing Hillary in 2008. Fast forward, she's Secretary of State. Sid Blumenthal connects Wilson to Clinton, and he successfully gets a $60 million-plus grant from a State Department fund that Hillary signed off on for a power plant that was built in Tanzania. And this was for a client of Wilson's who was paying him essentially as a foreign agent or a lobbyist. And, all of this is going on in the back channels of the Clinton Foundation and the State Department. And once again, I think that screams for deeper investigation.
I totally agree. But, even though we didn't have that investigation, the perception of scandal was enough to damage her. I think that the Clinton Foundation and the news about it and the corporate media couldn't ignore it definitely hurt her. I don't think there's any question about that. There were people who were convinced that there's crimes there, but we don't know that yet. But it hurt her, and it should be looked into. But right now she's a private citizen, and even Trump backed off, right? He doesn't want to jail her anymore.
So far.
Yeah.
That could change. We're just a tweet away.
Yeah, maybe. Well.
Now, let me turn to another thing that you explored in the book, which is her quote about the basket of deplorables and the way she described her perception of Trump supporters. And I do believe that was a very poor choice of epithet. But her message, when you and you, to your credit, published the entire quote, she went on to say things that showed she actually had some compassion for the people who were lining up to defeat her, and that she did understand or at least could put words to the pain of working class Americans.
Well, that was a public speech. You have to keep in mind that was not an email. That was not one of her Goldman Sachs or other Wall Street speeches. Mm-hmm. So she knew that this was being recorded. So on the one hand, yeah, she wanted to not alienate people. She certainly did with that remark. And on the other hand, she made this ridiculous statement, which I liken to basket of deplorables. Basket of deplorables sounds like basket of derivatives, equating people to commodities. This is a politician steeped in that culture and language of Wall Street. That's why I think she used this term, and it definitely backfired her. There was a poll immediately after that showed that. There were independents and others who may have been leaning towards Trump, and when they heard this, I think that certainly did not. That was a major blunder of hers in this campaign to make that statement. And it showed that even though she tried in that full remark to appear sympathetic to the losers, the so-called losers, as Trump's favorite word, the people who have been devastated unfairly by this neoliberal system, with these trade deals, with the cutting back of social services, with privatization, that she had no policies to help these people. She really wasn't addressing their interests. She refused to go to Notre Dame to speak because she didn't need the Catholic vote. That's in the Rust Belt. You know, she didn't think she needed these people because her brilliant campaign manager, Robbie Mook, thought he had it all figured out on the computer, where Bill Clinton, who knew a thing or two about campaigning, was telling her to go to Wisconsin, right? That was definitely a tactical mistake, there's no question. But it shows the deeper underlying lack of concern, her arrogance, her elitist ideas about her having money now, and real money. And this idea in the Democratic Party, even more so than the Republicans, who are led by plutocrats or who are viciously trying to gut whatever is left of the New Deal. But in this Democratic professional class now, who really think that they're it, you know, they've made it, and this just pervades corporate media and thinking too. I've worked for 30 years almost inside corporate media for big newspapers, and I know the mentality there. It's like you're working for a big newspaper like I was, and then there are everybody else. They don't count. And they live vicariously too much through the powerful people that they cover, and they lose the power the press has to really cut powerful people down to size when it's needed. And I think this is a fundamental problem with the media in this, the collusion between the campaign and the media as well. But Hillary Clinton did not have the policies, nor did she have the attitude to care enough about the people who sent her packing on November 8th. Trump, the showman that he is, cynically used those people and their suffering to appeal to them, and they took a chance with him because at least he was addressing their concerns, as Bernie Sanders was. But of course, by November 8th, he was way out of the picture for reasons that I go into in the book as well, that are well known about how the DNC conspired against him.
Sure.
So she is a woman who was a social climber all her life, like Bill Clinton, and she is, you know, as Colin Powell said, she's greedy and ambitious in one of the other leaked emails of Colin Powell's in this campaign. And this was she was focused on. You know, that other book I'm mentioning that it says the underlying message of that book is that she didn't really know why she was running.
Yeah.
It seems like that she wanted to be president. That was why she was running. But you can't go out and say, I want to be president because it's my turn. But basically, that's what the message was. It's my turn. And of course, she's doing it for women, but she's doing it for herself. That it would have a good knock-on effect on women, undoubtedly. And that's not a bad thing if a woman became president someday. But she was doing it, I think, because she's, as Colin Powell said, ambitious and greedy. And this is not and this came through. This came through. The emails that were leaked help confirm what people had thought about her all along. Now, it's debatable how much these emails really killed her in the end, her political future, or at least up until now. But certainly it confirmed what people suspected about her elitism, and certainly her hawkishness. As we know about Libya, now there's no doubt now that she was the driving force behind that. And the British Parliament, a parliamentary committee, revealed that there was no threat of any kind of genocide by Gaddafi. That he had actually put down rebellions in various towns, and no women or children were harmed in many of them, and there was little violence, and he talked a lot of them out of it with reforms. The guy was not moving on Benghazi. I I don't really want to mention Benghazi because I'm not talking about this ridiculous Republican investigation into it. Mm-hmm. You know, in a way, Clinton has gotten a favor because this is like almost a cover. The Benghazi, the Whitewater, these investigations that taken up so much money and time never came to anything. And it, she could say, I was investigated, you know, till the cows come home, and I was never charged with anything. And that's true because they were investigating the wrong things.
Right.
It's her involvement in Libya. Her destruction of this country, her role in the destruction of that country, her wanting to make Syria even worse than it is by wanting regime change there, her hawkishness across the board. Even Gail Sheehy, I don't mention this in the book, but in her biography of Hillary Clinton, says that Hillary claims she talked Bill into bombing Serbia over Kosovo. Now, Serbia did not attack the United States, and they didn't get a UN Security Council authorization, so it was an illegal bombing, whether you will agree with it or not, but legally it was illegal. And these kinds of things, Bill Clinton didn't get impeached for that illegal bombing. He got impeached for lying about a sexual act. I mean, the same thing with Trump. You know, he just bombed Syria illegally, technically. There was no authorization for this strike on a sovereign country. And yet they're going after him for a myth. Right now it is a mythical collusion with Russia. Now, there might be something to it. I have an open mind. Let's see. Speaking of open minds, Peter, I want to point out.
But there is no evidence either to support the claims that the DNC was hacked by Russia, and there is equally no evidence in public so far that there was direct collusion between the Trump campaign and any kind of Russian intelligence or government officers. And like you, I'm open-minded if somebody trots out some proof, but I'm certainly not going to embrace these conspiracy theories, which is what they are, when we have no evidence.
Right, they are. They are conspiracy theories at this point. And there's two main things. First of all, why believe the CIA, one of the most reputable organizations in recent history, based on deception and lies and disinformation? They are the sources originally for the corporate media reports that Russia hacked and stole this election. Number two, our skepticism grows because Clapper said he would release the evidence, and then he came out with this ridiculous January 6th report, which basically attacks RT.
Right.
And what is RT? Now, RT is like any corporate, anybody's media is going to be not necessarily looking into what's wrong in their domestic policy, but they're going to criticize what other people are doing, and this is a platform to criticize U.S. foreign policy that is not criticized in the corporate media, which has an agenda for keeping out stories critical of U.S. For example, that DIA document. I pitched it twice to a big newspaper. It was twice rejected. It was not published by anybody else. It was only online that you found that. And that's an authentic – I called the Pentagon. I spoke to a Pentagon spokesman. He confirmed it was real. He said it was raw intelligence, but it was sent to the DHS, it was sent to the FBI, to the CIA, it was sent everywhere. Nobody acted on it, what we were talking about before, that the Islamic State would be created out of this Salafist principality that the United States and their partners in the region were supporting. And this is what the press doesn't cover. They have an agenda to support American foreign policy. That's not journalism when you're supporting the agenda, any agenda. And this is a real, real problem. And Hillary Clinton is central to all of these issues on foreign policy that have gone so wrong. She's a liberal interventionist, which is dressing up the neoconservative regime change argument to impose not democracy around the world. And I have a slight section on Hillary Clinton and the American myth, where she comes right out, like Ronald Reagan said, you know, a city on a shining hill. She believes this stuff. Does she believe it? Actually, I asked this question. Is she cynical about it and just saying these things because this is what the ruling class needs to say, what she needs to say? Or does she really believe it? She's a pretty clever woman, and she knows, having been Secretary of State, a lot about American skullduggery around the world and what intelligence agencies have done. I suspect she's being cynical in supporting this idea of Americans spreading democracy when what they're spreading is this neoliberal system that benefits U.S. and foreign capital and local oligarchs and impoverishes the local population. We've seen it now in Ukraine. We've seen it in Libya. It's been a disaster. They're trying to impose this everywhere in Iraq and in Greece. So we know that the U.S. does not spread democracy. And the best evidence of that is that they have overthrown a democratically elected president in 1953 in Iran. They put a king on the throne. They overthrew a democratically elected president in 1954 in Guatemala, and they put a military dictatorship in charge. They were complicit in some ways with the overthrow of Allende in Chile and put a fascistic military dictator. So they're not spreading.
And let's just fast forward to 2009 in Honduras, mess that both Bill and Hillary left after the earthquake in Haiti. I mean, the damage, the trail that they've left behind is significant. And, you know, it is generally whitewashed in the corporate media. Joe, I want to turn to the Wall Street speeches and circle back to the greed comment that you attributed to Colin Powell. Hillary gave speeches that earned her over $22 million after she left the State Department and before she declared for the presidency. And it is really hard to look at that and say, oh, well, you know, everybody does it. And Obama's given a speech for $400,000 in the fall to a Wall Street firm. But these really, because she refused to release the transcripts for so long, it really became the only humorous element of Bernie Sanders' stump speech, where he'd talk about, wow, those must have been really good speeches. And he was able to connect with people who were already skeptical, who already believed that the Clintons identify with the 1% and not the 99%. And you actually read the Goldman Sachs speeches, and we have some significant excerpts in your book. Talk a little bit about what she said and why she was unwilling to release those transcripts.
Well, in hindsight, it was a huge mistake for her not to, but she didn't see WikiLeaks coming down the pike. She thought that this would be, remain hidden, and that she could overcome the demands of not only Sanders, but then Trump later, and the New York Times, and many people, that she could withstand that. And she was unable to do that. Another thing that was revealed, I will go back to Wall Street, but on health insurance, she tells a Canadian audience up in Saskatoon, who enjoy one of the best government-run health programs anywhere, that she's really in favor of that. So she won't say that publicly. But, you know, so these emails reveal what her real positions are. What does she say to Wall Street? She essentially says that she is going to bat for them when 2008 occurred, when the crash of 2008 occurred. She went around the world and took a lot of flack from them. From everywhere she went, people were asking, because let's face it, 2008 affected the world economy. People all over the world where she went as Secretary of State were approaching her. We're talking about foreign ministers and other government officials, and maybe citizens of those countries, if she spoke with them, businessmen, why did this happen? Can this happen again? So she had to defend Wall Street, and she doesn't seem too pleased about doing that, but she's saying in these speeches she'll do it again, and she knows where the money's going to come from. In the back of the book, we have quite a long appendix there, and it has a list of all the contributions, all of her fundraising dinners, how much she got, who gave what, and what Goldman Sachs gave, and this type of thing. You know, the banks, she knows where the money's coming from, and she has to keep them on side. And she speaks their language, and she's going to be their president. That's what you really get the essence of this. And she has sympathy for them. She says at one point that, you know, it's unfair the way rich people are being treated. And, of course, she's including herself in that. You get the sense that she's happy to have joined the club, that she'd striven her entire life from the time, you know, she married Bill Clinton, that she's wanted to be, to get there, to make it, and that she in many ways embodies this American characteristic of success at all costs without concern for the effects it has on other people. And in business, that's bad enough, but you want to be president. This is not the attitude to have. And she was unable to then, even as Trump did, the liar, you know, showed that she really cared about average people. She says at one point, because, you know, the way my husband and I have been fortunate, I'm really out of touch. I'm far removed, is the exact quote. Far removed from the ordinary people. This was in one of the secret speeches that became revealed by WikiLeaks. So she's telling these guys, I need your money. I'm going to go to bat for you. You're unfairly treated. I'm one of you now. And don't worry, we got this in the bag. And did not see WikiLeaks coming down the pike, nor Donald Trump, and how he cleverly played to the insecurities of vast numbers of formerly middle-class Americans. And they're getting screwed by him now as well. So the speeches are crucial, and she knew that. But it's funny because she didn't really make an appeal to those people anyway, but she knew if those speeches came out that no one would ever believe for a second that she had their concern, that she had their interests in mind, and she didn't. And then the speeches came out, and they found out for sure that she didn't. As I say, most of these emails confirm what people suspected about her, mm-hmm. With now details, with actual quotes. I'm far removed from you. I don't care about you. And, you know, so why the hell should they vote for her is what the message is. And then they didn't in the places where she needed it, well, in the Rust Belt.
Joe, I want to pick just one of the Goldman Sachs excerpts that you cite in the book. And this is on page 129. It's June 4th, 2013. And I'll point out to listeners that the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, essentially was the moderator of these discussions with Hillary, so that for $225,000, he got FaceTime with the woman he thought was the future president. And in this one response from Clinton, she does make some interesting predictions, because, again, this is in 2013. She says, I'm actually more concerned about Europe from another perspective. I think that unless the national leaders and the European Union and Eurozone leaders get their act together, you will see some pretty unpredictable leaders and political parties coming to the forefront in a lot of countries. You'll see a lot of nationalism. You will see a lot of chauvinism. You'll see UK parties that winning elections are going to push Cameron and his coalition government to the right as it moves towards an election. Now, she has some pretty, I think, smart observations there. But then she talks about essentially the austerity programs that have been imposed on Greece and other European countries, and she euphemizes it. They have to take a lot of really unpleasant medicines, and some are more willing to do that than others, and see whether or not they have the political will to make these hard decisions individually and collectively. So she has no sense, and of course she's talking to Goldman Sachs, which helped create the Greek financial crisis, but she doesn't seem to have any sense of the suffering of the average pension holder in Greece, who's taken a huge haircut so that the German banks can recover their loans.
Yeah, just like she had that warning about the Islamic State coming and ignored it, she knew what was going to happen in Europe by predicting, yes, that the right-wing populist parties would grow. I don't think she understood that that could happen in the U.S. against her either, which is what happened. But again, what is her solution for that? None. There is none. You say she supports the austerity. And she doesn't see that it's the failure, in my view, of the left that has brought the populist right-wing parties to prominence in Europe and now with Donald Trump inside the United States, that there is no left, and that the Democratic Party under Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton moved away from their traditional base with the labor unions, moved to the center, as we all well know, their triangulation and all that, and got in with the neoliberal, this market fundamentalist position where government will get out of the way of businessmen to make a hell of a lot of money and impoverish a lot of people, because those regulations are there to make it a little bit more, a little fairer playing field for everyone in the economy. And Bill Clinton presided over and signed the massive deal that got rid of Glass-Steagall, and then that paved the way for his Treasury Secretary, Rubin, to become the CEO of this super bank that was created. But Citibank and Travelers merged. That wasn't possible before. They had to get rid of that regulation. Mm-hmm. That was what the whole... And he was personally, Robert Rubin was personally had a stake in that while he was in government looking to the future, because he became the CEO of this monster bank. And that led to, you know, I'm simplifying things here, obviously, but that led to the 2008, in many ways, crash, when we didn't have these kinds of regulations and protections in place anymore. So the Clintons were responsible for that in a large measure, and they are the failure of the left. Without labor-based parties, and we see the same thing in Britain with Tony Blair. It's just labor is in name, labor party is in name only. And now with Corbyn, he's trying to restore the connection to the labor unions and reject this neoliberalism where government gets out of the way of businessmen and there's no regulations and privatization and IMF loans and all the ways they do to enrich themselves at the expense of other people. And she is the failure of the left. The Clintons or represent that. They have stepped out of the way, and she opened the way to this right-wing popularism in the United States and probably didn't see it coming, despite her a prognostication here in this speech that you point out, that this is where Europe is headed. And so, you know, you got to give a fair deal to the working class people, to middle class people. You cannot screw them to enrich people who are already super rich, because then there's going to be the backlash. And we've seen the backlash. And if there's not a left-wing party there to represent their interests, and there is no party in Britain, although Labour's trying to do it, there certainly is the Democratic, U.S. Democratic Party, is not representing the interests of average Americans, working class, middle class Americans. They are representing professional class and higher, and they have their bankers, and they've got their super rich behind them as well. So we've got two parties representing only the upper crust, basically, of our society, and the hell with everyone else. And there you're going to get a chump like Donald Trump marching in there to, and you're going to get these right-wing parties, which of course has been fueled also by the refugee crisis, which was in large measure created by this hawkish interventionist policies of Hillary Clinton. Well, and Joe, the neocons before that.
Joe, yeah. I just have to tell you that I jotted down a little note about that section that I just cited, and I wrote, Hillary predicts nationalism in Europe, not U.S. And this is just another example of how, as I read this book, I kept cheering you on and saying, yeah, Joe, that's right. Yeah, I would say that. So yeah. I really feel that your commentary in the book really does give the reader a broader sense of the context and the failures that led to Hillary Clinton's electoral loss. And that leads to my final question. The title of your book is How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Any lawyers raise red flags about that she could say, wait a minute, I didn't write this book?
Well, that became an issue. That became an issue when the book was first thought of a couple of months ago. Before this title was thought of. But, you know, it's in the public domain. WikiLeaks has released it.
Yeah.
Let's see. I don't think there will be any legal repercussions, but I don't know. I can't really answer that question. But everyone has read these parts of these emails, and we've heard of the emails. So we've collected them in this book, and I've created the commentary to help give a context, a recent historical context, for the policies that she's espousing in these emails that I think lost her this election.
Well,
and
she did not
write the book. Yeah, she did not write the book. She only wrote some of the emails and made these speeches. So in that sense, it's by her. We use her own words.
Right. No, I think it's a very clever and catchy title. And if it draws a little lawyering, it might help sell more copies. And I'll also reference, you got a foreword by Julian Assange, which I think helps set the context for the book itself. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us. I enjoyed this conversation, and I really do appreciate the work you've done on this to focus on the critical issues that were the underpinnings of the colossal loss by the Democrats and candidate Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Well, thank you very much, Pete. I'm glad I had a chance to talk about it with you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Joe Lauria. I welcome your comments. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.